This episode of the Court Junkie podcast is sponsored by Audible.com. If you love listening to podcasts, you will love these audiobooks. Today's recommendation is Murder in the Family, a true crime story about a horrific murder in Anchorage, Alaska. You can get that audiobook for free, or another one of your choosing, if you go to audibletrial.com/courtjunkie. Sign up for a free 30-day trial and receive one free audiobook. It's a great deal and it's free. You can cancel anytime, and it's a great way to support your favorite podcasts, which, hopefully, this is one of them. That's audibletrial.com/courtjunkie. Hello, and welcome to episode 6 of the Court Junkie podcast. First, a quick thank you to everybody who has subscribed, shared, reviewed this podcast, and of course, those who have donated via patreon.com, where you can donate as little as a dollar. Your support is amazing. If you like the show, please consider leaving a review. Now on to the episode. Today we're going back to 2006, to a small Canadian city in Alberta called Medicine Hat. With a population of about 65,000 people, it boasts a vibrant arts and cultural scene, a down-home atmosphere, and some memorable coffee shops. There are more than 100 parks and over 56 miles of walking trails. It's affectionately called Canada's sunniest city. And in Canada's sunniest city, there is a 12-year-old girl who we'll call JR, for reasons I'll explain in a minute. JR wasn't your typical 12-year-old girl that you're probably picturing in your head right now. She had long brown hair, big brown eyes, wore dark makeup, revealing clothes, and had a 23-year-old boyfriend named Jeremy Steinke. JR was also about to become the youngest person to ever be charged with multiple counts of murder in Canada. I have to warn you that this case is disturbing on quite a few levels, but I wanted to cover it because it's a case that's going to prove extremely important in the issue of rehabilitation versus punishment. This case is interesting for a number of reasons, the main one being how young JR was when she committed cold-blooded murder of her family. JR was born in 1994, the first child of Mark and Deborah Richardson. Her younger brother, Jacob, was born 4 years later. Their father, Mark, was in oil field construction, and mother, Deborah, was a stay-at-home mom. In 2006, Mark was 42 and Deborah was 48. 12-year-old JR reportedly met her much older boyfriend, Jeremy, early in 2006 through a mutual friend. According to accounts from her friends, after JR met Jeremy, she reportedly started to change. She started wearing dark makeup and hanging out with an older crowd. And not only was Jeremy more than twice JR's age, he was also unemployed and was a high school dropout. You know, every parent's dream for their daughter. He was living in a trailer park at the time and was reportedly big into drugs. Jeremy had quite an online presence on social media sites too, including Nexopia, Bolt, and Vampire Freaks. He went by the name Soul Eater, and his profile pics consisted of photos of him wearing all black with a shaved head and dark eyeliner. In his bio, Jeremy listed his interests: scarification, pain, kinky fetishes, blood, razor blades. On one of his profiles, he described himself as a gothic individual who believes in blood, destruction, guts, gore, and greed. "Am I God's champion or Satan's angel?" he wrote. He also reportedly told his friends that he was a 300-year-old werewolf and he wore a vial of blood around his neck. Interesting. JR had online profiles on those sites too. She went by the moniker Runaway Devil, and her bio said that she was bisexual, Wiccan, nocturnal, awkward, a deep thinker, and insane. Her interests included dark poetry, criminal psychology, blood, human anatomy, and kinky shit. And yes, she was 12 years old at the time. And like almost every set of parents on the planet would, her parents disapproved of her relationship. Strongly, in fact. When JR's parents found out about her 23-year-old werewolf boyfriend, they were horrified. Her parents caught JR and Jeremy kissing at a local punk rock show, and JR was grounded and forbidden to never see Jeremy again. This devastated the couple, who continued to communicate online, and it wasn't long before their communication turned into a deadly plot. In one message, written about a month prior to the murders, JR, going by Runaway Devil, wrote to Jeremy, "I miss you more than killing people. Can we get together and kill people?" She then wrote about her parents. "I hate them, so I have this plan. It begins with me killing them and ends with me living with you." Jeremy, responding as Soul Eater, said, "Well, I love your plan, but we need to get a little more creative with the details and stuff." During the early afternoon of Sunday, April 23rd, 2006, a little boy showed up at the Richardson house, wanting to see if JR's little brother Jacob could come out and play. When the boy looked through the window, he saw a body lying on the ground. He ran home to tell his mother, who called 911 at 1:34 in the afternoon.
"Yeah, we got a call to go to, there was a complaint. One of the neighbors had called in and was concerned that they went over to the Richardson's house and that there was a body seen in the basement window of the house. So it came in as kind of suspicious activity, possible persons injured in the house."
That's Brent Sakondiak. He's an inspector with the Medicine Hat Police Service, who I spoke with about this case. In 2006, Brent was a street sergeant on one of the patrol teams. And as he said, he was the first responding officer to the scene.
"I was only a few blocks away when the call came in the early afternoon. I attended to the scene. I took some of our tools out because I wasn't sure what we were dealing with. I believe I brought a shield, and of course I had my service firearm. I approached the house kind of by myself and looked in through the window and saw what I believed to be two bodies laying down through the basement of the window. So I couldn't exactly tell what state they were in, if they were in medical distress. I could just definitely see two bodies laying down, and it wasn't in a normal spot on a couch. It was like on the floor. So I called for a backup. So I think five members came. The first member that came, I sent them to the back of the residence to secure the back. And then the next four members that came, we kind of came up with a plan to enter the house to determine what was wrong and if these people were in any type of medical distress, any help we could render. So the door was locked, so we used a ram, and we entered the front door of the house. Immediately upon entering, there was large amounts of blood we could see on the walls. It was a four-level split, so we came in kind of on the second level, starting from the top, looked down, we saw two people that looked to be, they were covered in blood and looked to be deceased at the time."
JR's mom and dad, Mark and Deborah, were found dead in the basement. Mark had suffered 24 stab wounds and Deborah had 12. The basement was a blood-spattered mess, and there was evidence that an intense struggle had taken place.
"Two of the members, myself and one other one, held kind of the upstairs, and I sent two of my tactical team members, they're on patrols, but they're members of our tactical team, down to the basement. They confirmed that the two people in the basement appeared to be deceased. They cleared the basement. I held upstairs, and then when they were finished with the basement, myself and the rest of the team went upstairs. So, and as we were moving upstairs, the first bedroom on the left-hand side, I entered the room first, and we saw the body of a young boy. He was deceased on his bed, nearly naked. He was in his underwear in his bed, and he had obvious throat injuries, appeared to be some type of cut or something to his throat, and he was deceased as well."
JR's 8-year-old brother Jacob was found dead upstairs in his bed, having suffered 5 stab wounds, including major cuts to his throat. I bet that's not the kind of call you were expecting when you first got that, huh?
No, not on a Sunday afternoon. It was, you know, a rather quiet day. We were doing some training otherwise. But, yeah, it was quite traumatic. There was a large amount of blood in the house, and I'll never forget there was a handprint kind of smeared in blood down the hallway. So, you know, as soon as you go into a scene like that, you're just, you know, your training kicks in, and, you know, you're just taught to clear the rooms, check to see if anybody's alive or can provide first aid or assist anybody in there. But it was quite obvious that everyone was deceased and had been for several hours. But yeah, it was shocking and horrific for everybody that was there.
As officers continued to work the scene, they spotted some framed photographs of the Richardson family. They noticed that there was a fourth member of the family, what looked to be a young daughter, who was also depicted in the photographs.
So it was obvious in the house. We were dealing with a family, so we saw lots of pictures in the house as we were clearing it of a family. So we knew that there was a girl missing, a young girl. So we immediately, you know, were concerned for her safety. We didn't know if there was a kidnapping or if she was there or not. You know, when it was a Sunday early afternoon, so we thought maybe she was with friends or on a sleepover. So we immediately started calling our school resource officers. There was a school a few blocks away, so we just assumed that that's the school she probably went to. So we had our school resource officers, you know, called and to see if they knew the family and if they could find out, you know, if she had any friends or might be anywhere in the area.
An Amber Alert was issued. And at that point, officers were concerned that the missing young girl must have been taken by the killer.
So we went into her school locker to see, you know, if there's any type of evidence that we could find in there that might help us find out where she might be. And within the locker, we found some evidence that, you know, this was probably pre-planned and that there was probably some premeditation going on to the murder of her family with her boyfriend.
And then I don't know if you can comment specifically on what you found in there. I think I read that there was like some sort of drawing that she had done.
Yeah, I never specifically saw that evidence, but that was my understanding. There was some type of written documentation as well as a drawing of the murder of her family.
In JR's locker, police reportedly found a crude drawing that showed JR's family dead inside their house, while JR was depicted as standing outside with her boyfriend.
As soon as we saw that, that was the first time that, you know, she was definitely a person of interest at that point forward. Then we focused our investigation on, okay, you know, she's definitely a person of interest. We're trained not to have tunnel vision, but it actually never crossed my mind that a 12-year-old would do anything like this. So it was truly, you know, my ignorance, I guess. I just didn't think that a 12-year-old would be capable of this, but lesson learned, I guess. So it was truly altruistic when we went into the office and into her locker eventually to try and find her. Turns out she was instrumental in the planning of her family's murder. So, yeah, it was shocking for all of us.
Meanwhile, JR and Jeremy were spotted at multiple friends' houses, eating fast food, making out, and even laughing and joking about the murders they had just committed. The next day, JR and Jeremy were arrested at a gas station, along with three of their friends, a few hours away from Medicine Hat, in a town called Saskatchewan. Inside Jeremy's truck, police found a copy of the day's Medicine Hat news with a headline about the murders. While JR and Jeremy sat in jail awaiting their trial, they wrote love letters to each other, which were later presented in court. In the letters, JR writes about how much she misses Jeremy and tells him that her lawyer told her that they're legends. Jeremy responded that he loves her more than life itself and that he added her to his visitors list so that once she's released, she can go visit him. He tells her, "Stay true to your promises, and I shall to mine." He closes out the letter with, "P.S. You said you want to get engaged? Then here's a cue. Will you marry me? If so, then it is a verbal agreement." JR's letter back to him sounds giddy. She says, "Ah ha ha ha. I never thought I'd find myself hysterically laughing in a holding cell in these kind of circumstances. Or ever, really. But still, You make me so happy. Yes, I will. I would love to. Of course, I'll come visit you. You'll have to find out where you're being held. God, I'm so happy. I must be happily insane then. In addition to her giddiness over having just gotten engaged through prison letters, she seems obsessed with their media coverage. She says, "We've been in the papers every day, apparently. I haven't seen them, but hopefully can on Monday." JR was the first to go on trial in June 2007. She was 14 years old at the time, and she was pleading not guilty to 3 counts of first-degree murder. In her opening statement, Crown Attorney Stephanie Cleary told the jury that all 3 victims had been repeatedly stabbed in their home. She said some of the evidence found at the home included 2 knives, one that was found downstairs and another one in an upstairs bathroom. Both had blood on them. Medicine Hat Police Officer Gerald Sadelmeyer testified that when he went upstairs to Jacob's room, he found the sheets soaked in blood and that there was blood splattered on the walls, the door, and on various toys strewn around the room. In the basement, Sadelmeyer said he found Deborah at the bottom of the stairs, covered in blood and clutching a handful of hair. He testified that they found the body of Mark Richardson nearby, wearing only his boxer shorts. He had stab wounds to nearly every part of his body, which indicated that there had been a violent struggle. He said blood spatter covered almost everything in the basement, including the TV, an exercise ball, and the fireplace. Officer Sadelmeyer showed the jury some of the 1,500 photos taken at the home, some of which brought the jurors to tears. A cab driver who had picked up JR after the murders and drove her to Jeremy's trailer testified that JR appeared calm and cool and that he never would have imagined that she had just taken part in her family's murder. 4 of JR's friends also testified. They had been in 7th grade when the killings occurred. 2 of the girls testified that JR was a nice girl at first, but that she drastically changed after she started dating Jeremy. They said JR had told them several times that she wanted to kill her parents and run away with Jeremy because her parents were trying to keep them apart. Another girl said she overheard JR on the phone with Jeremy, asking him to help her kill her parents. All of the girls said they never took JR's threats seriously. Yet another friend who had been with JR and Jeremy when they were arrested testified that JR had asked her to lie for them. One of the officers who arrested JR and Jeremy also took the stand. He said that JR and the 3 friends she was with at the time of her arrest were put in the back of a police car where they yelled obscenities and giggled. When it was the defense's turn to put on their case, JR was called to the stand as their only witness. In contrast to the revealing goth-like clothes she had been wearing at the time of the murders, she was now dressed more modestly. Her hair was in a ponytail, and she wore a blue blouse with black pants. She reportedly spoke in a voice just above a whisper. JR said that she and Jeremy had hypothetical conversations about killing her parents. She said they used to talk late at night about how much she hated her parents and that they discussed possible ways of killing them, including making it look like a murder-suicide or hitting them on the head while they slept and then burning their house down. She said the plans included killing her brother because they didn't think it was fair for him to grow up without parents. JR said she never took the conversation seriously and that it was just stupid talk. She said it wasn't unusual for her and her group of friends to talk about killing people. JR said that a week prior to the murders, she snuck out of her house and went to Jeremy's trailer where they had sex. She said they had sex another time at her friend's apartment after the murders, right before the bodies were found. She said she had sex with Jeremy because I loved him so much, I thought it would bring us closer together. JR testified that on the night of April 22, 2006, she had called Jeremy and told him that she wanted to kill her parents because they were mean to her. She told the court that she had only been joking about it, but later that night she woke up to the sound of Jeremy breaking into their house. She said her mom was the first to go downstairs and that she could hear her screaming. She said her father then went downstairs and she could hear him and Jeremy fighting. When she went downstairs, she said she saw her mom lying in blood. She said she then ran back upstairs and grabbed a knife that she kept in her closet in order to protect herself. She said Jeremy came upstairs covered in blood and that he yelled at her to kill her brother. She said, "He yells at me, stab him, just stab him, slit his throat." She said she refused at first. I said, "I can't, I can't." And he said, "You have to. I did this for you." JR broke down on the stand as she recalled Jacob's last words to her. "I'm scared. I'm too young to die." She said she then stabbed him once, somewhere on his upper body, but that she couldn't do anything else. She said Jeremy then grabbed the knife and slit Jacob's throat. She said she couldn't watch, but she heard Jacob struggling to breathe. She told the jury that he was gurgling. On cross-examination, Crown Attorney Cleary asked JR why she didn't try to stop the murders or didn't tell anybody about them afterwards. She pointed out that JR could have called 911 or run to a neighbor's home for help. JR replied that she was in shock and was practically sleepwalking. "I was like a zombie. I could barely function," she said. "It didn't even enter my mind to call 911. Cleary brought up JR stabbing her little brother, saying that instead of telling him to run, she put him in a chokehold and stabbed him. Cleary also brought up JR's actions after the murders, in which JR stole from her mother's purse, got a taxi, withdrew money from an ATM, and then met Jeremy back at his trailer. She said that if there was no plan to kill her family, JR would have begged him to stop or even called for help. JR just kept saying, "There was no plan." JR's attorney, Tim Foster, said in closing arguments that JR did not help plan the murders. He said, "Although she talked about it, although she said those things, she never ever meant it. In order to find her guilty, you have to find that intent. You have to find that she intended for Jeremy to kill her family." He then went on to say that JR and Jeremy didn't have a destination in mind to run away to after the murders, and that JR hadn't packed a bag in advance, and that Jeremy left her at the home after the murders. He said that proves that there was no planning on her part. In her closing arguments, Crown Attorney Cleary told jurors that JR's testimony wasn't believable and that her explanation of being in a trance-like state couldn't be trusted. She said, "The reason her tale doesn't make sense is not because she's 12 and not because she was involved with Jeremy, but because it's not true." She said JR was not a zombie that night, that she was thinking clearly and following a plan. Cleary said that after the murders, JR packed a bag full of clothes, stole her mom's ATM card, went to a nearby convenience store to take money out of that ATM, and then took a taxi to Jeremy's trailer. Then, she and Jeremy went to a friend's apartment, where they had sex and were seen cuddling. And this was only hours after she stabbed her little brother and witnessed the bloodshed of her family being killed. Cleary said that at no time did JR make any effort to call police, seek help, or even check on her family to see if they were still alive. Judge Scott Booker told the jurors before their deliberations that even if Jeremy was the one who physically did the killings, under Canadian law, JR could be found guilty if they find that she intentionally helped, encouraged, or persuaded him to commit the crime. He gave them three options on each of the charges: find JR guilty of first-degree murder, guilty of second-degree murder, or innocent. He said that to find her guilty of first-degree murder, they must find that the Crown proved that there was planning and deliberation involved. The jury, which consisted of 7 men and 5 women, deliberated for 3 hours before returning their verdict. After the month-long trial on July 9, 2007, the jury found JR guilty and convicted her of 3 counts of first-degree murder. As the verdict was read, JR cried as she sat in the prisoner's box with her hand over her mouth. Her attorney put his arm around her. 5 months later, on November 8th, 2007, JR was sentenced. And due to her age, she received a 10-year intensive rehabilitative custody and supervision sentence. It's a sentence that falls under Canada's Youth Criminal Justice Act, which states that anyone who is under the age of 14 at the time they commit a crime cannot be charged as adults and can only be given a maximum sentence of 10 years. She was ordered to serve 6 years in custody at a psychiatric hospital, two of which she had already served, followed by 4 years of supervision. And that was the price JR paid for wiping out her entire family. Jeremy went on trial in November of 2008. Before trial, Jeremy had fought for and won a change of venue, so as a result, his trial was held in Calgary, about 3 hours away from Medicine Hat. The Crown told the jury that Jeremy and JR had planned the murders and that the motive was adolescent rage at JR's parents, who disapproved of their relationship. They said that JR was the motive and Jeremy was the means, and that Jeremy would do anything for JR, including participating in the planned and deliberate murders of her family. The defense's theory was that Jeremy was the victim of a brutalized childhood, a lovesick loser who was too hopped up on drugs and alcohol to form the intent to kill. Jeremy's attorney told the court that the killings were an impulsive reaction triggered by Jeremy's excessive intoxication and drug abuse that night. The trial went on for 2.5 weeks, and in addition to physical evidence in the form of DNA that linked Jeremy to the crimes, the Crown played audio from a conversation an undercover officer posing as an inmate had with Jeremy as he was being transported to jail. In the recording, Jeremy says to the undercover officer, "You hear about that triple homicide? You're looking at him. And me and my old lady have become legends." Jeremy told him that he tried talking JR out of it, but that she wouldn't have it that way, and that he's a man of his word. He also described the night of the murders. He said JR's dad came downstairs and tried fighting him off with a screwdriver. He said JR's dad asked him why he was doing this, and Jeremy said he told him, "Because your daughter wanted it this way." He then said JR was the one who killed her brother and that she wasn't even upset about it afterwards. He also said in the recording that JR told him that as soon as she gets released, she's going to visit him. "You ever watch the movie Natural Born Killers?" he asked. "I think that's the best love story of all time." The court also heard that the night before the murders, Jeremy watched Natural Born Killers twice. And for those who haven't seen it, the movie opens with a girl and her boyfriend murdering her family and then running away. The Crown also presented several of Jeremy's friends who told the court that he had tried to recruit them to help, and when they refused, he threatened them. Another friend of Jeremy's told the jury that Jeremy had bragged about the killings afterwards and said that he gutted JR's parents like fish. Another witness said she saw Jeremy and JR smiling as they read newspaper coverage of the killings. Jeremy showed no reaction as the guilty verdicts were read out loud in court. He was sentenced to life in prison with no chance of parole for 25 years. Two other people were charged in the case. A 20-year-old female friend of Jeremy's was charged with being an accessory to murder after admitting to washing down his truck after the murders. And a 17-year-old girl was also charged with being an accessory to murder, but she pleaded guilty to obstruction of justice instead and received 20 months of probation. JR served 4 years in a psychiatric institution and 4.5 years under conditional supervision in the community. To qualify for that sentence under the Youth Criminal Justice Act, It states that the young offender must be diagnosed with some form of mental disorder or emotional disturbance. Although JR's psychiatric assessments were never made public, it has been released that she was diagnosed with conduct disorder and oppositional defiant disorder. The court was provided regular updates about JR's therapy. In November 2009, 2 years after her sentencing, it was noted that JR was undergoing intensive rehabilitation at the Alberta Hospital and that she was about to begin having supervised trips off the hospital grounds. 6 months later, in June 2010, the court heard that JR was making progress in therapy, but that she was lagging in accepting the severity of her crimes. In 2011, JR was released from the hospital, and her integration back into society began. She moved to a group home and started studying at Mount Royal University in Calgary. By October 2012, JR was living on her own while working and taking classes. Her team said she was responding positively to treatment, expressing genuine remorse, and was assessed at a low risk to reoffend. And just earlier this year, in May 2016, just 10 years after the brutal murders of her family, JR made her final court appearance. Her sentence was deemed successfully completed, and at 22 years old, JR is now essentially a free woman. What's more, if she doesn't commit any crimes over the next 5 years, the murders will be completely wiped from her record. This case brings out a lot of feelings. Disbelief that a 12-year-old child could do something like this. Sadness for her parents whose lives were cruelly taken away from them. And then a feeling that you can't quite put into words over the fact that JR stabbed her little brother and then laughed about it afterwards. And then there's the fact that as I'm speaking to you right now, JR is free. Free to eat what she wants, wear what she wants, date who she wants. Free to live her life however she wishes. And 5 years from now, if her record is truly expunged, no one will ever have to know that she was once convicted of murdering her entire family. Brent says he used to have mixed feelings about it, but that he's come to terms with the situation.
You know, I've gone through a whole bunch of emotions over the past over 10 years. So I know how easily influenced a 12-year-old child can be, but maybe not to this extent. But I was, at one point in my life, I was so angry with her. I was upset with the justice system that she wasn't incarcerated, that there wasn't, she wasn't being treated as an adult, that there wasn't more being done. But I think over the last few years, I've actually felt kind of sorry for her. You know, that's probably where I'm at now. I've kind of, I hope she does well with her life, and she must have some horrible demons, and she's going to have to face her maker one day, not me. But I've kind of moved past my anger with her, and I truly hope she can find some type of peace.
There's a lot of debate over whether JR's sentence was too lenient, or if she is truly rehabilitated and can now be a productive member of society. If she does have a mental illness, hopefully she did receive the treatment she needed and will continue to do so. I can't help but think that if these murders occurred in the United States, JR would possibly have been tried as an adult, and her sentence would have been much more severe. But would she have received rehabilitation or just punishment? And can people like her, people who are capable of premeditated killing at such a young age, truly be rehabilitated? JR was just a child at the time, perhaps influenced by someone who is much older than her.
I know that 12-year-olds can be manipulated. And when we had a 20-some-year-old male that was obviously involved in her life, and she was infatuated by him, and it's my belief that, you know, he manipulated her and that he was the real root cause of all this problem. It doesn't excuse anything she did, and I don't think she'll ever be forgiven for what she did, but I understand it more. And I truly hope that she gets the help she needs and she can be productive in her life moving forward.
So the question remains, has JR served her time, been rehabilitated, and is now ready to be a functioning member of society? Or would you be a little unnerved knowing that she now lives right next door? Jeremy will be out of jail too someday. He'll be eligible to apply for day parole in April 2028 and full parole in April 2031. So he'll basically be out by the time he's 50 years old. I also can't help but think back to Jeremy's favorite movie, Natural Born Killers. At the very end of the movie, you see the murderous couple happily driving around in an RV with little kids running around in the back. It's Hollywood, of course, but I find myself hoping that evil like that doesn't really exist. And that's all for this episode of Court Junkie. If you like the show, please leave me a review. And if you want to help support the podcast, it's super easy. You can go to patreon.com/courtjunkie and donate as little as a dollar. Or you can go to audibletrial.com/courtjunkie and sign up for a free 30-day trial. You get one free audio download and you can cancel at any time. You can find me on Twitter at courtjunkiepod or on Facebook at courtjunkie. You can also email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. Thanks for listening.